The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, hairy bodies, compound eyes, feather-like antenna. The perhaps misunderstood moth is in the limelight in the experimental documentary film The Night Visitors. The movie provides a glimpse into a world many of us overlook. We'll speak with filmmaker Michael Gitlin. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Okay, I had to face some fears for this next segment. Today's show is about moths, or it's about a movie about moths. New York-based filmmaker Michael Gitlin is the director of The Night Visitors. The 2023 film is about creatures that are often overlooked. The Night Visitors offers stunning photography of the insects from larvae to adults. The moth's feather-like antenna, colorful wings, and teddy bear-like fur are captured in extraordinary detail. But beyond capturing the beauty and strangeness of these animals, The Night Visitors also explores themes of presence and mortality. The film carries an environmental message, too, exploring an ill-fated experiment to capitalize on American silk more than a century ago that created an ecological disaster we are still grappling with. The Night Visitors is presented in a unique, experimental style. Think David Attenborough meets David Lynch. To learn more, I spoke with Michael Gitlin.
I mean, it's really the style of all my films. I make, I think, what you could call experimental documentaries. I love those kind of, you know, like a nature film, like a David Attenborough film, but it's not the kind of film that I would make or really even could make. I often think of a quote from a filmmaker that I like a great deal, a narrative filmmaker, Robert Bresson, the French filmmaker, who's got a little book of aphorisms called Notes on the Cinematographer that's really great. And he says, make visible that which without you would never be seen. And so that's, you know, I sort of think of that as a way of thinking about how do you make a film. You make a film that makes visible the thing that if you didn't make that film, it wouldn't be seen. And so that sort of feeds into that style, that sort of, as you say, impressionistic or somewhat experimental style. And I think that that aphorism, making visible what without you would never be seen, is maybe particularly apt for this film because it's this little world, this kind of hidden world that most people don't know about, that's really just in your own backyard.
About 200 species of moths have appeared at the lights in my backyard. With a bit more persistence or ambition, it would be possible to see more than 1,000 species there.
So the insects that are featured in the film, you have close-up shots, and they're incredibly visually interesting. They're, you know, you think of the Luna moth and the feather-like antenna, and there's this fur that looks like it's a pet. It looks like my cat. and you wouldn't see this without this kind of photography. So is that something that you deliberately wanted before you even started the film, is zoom in on a creature that in a lot of cases is unnoticed or ignored?
Yeah, totally. I might back up a step and sort of talk for a moment about where the film came from or how I started the film, because it sort of leads into that. Speaking of Luna moths, I got in my head that I wanted to see a Luna moth. I'd never seen one. I'd seen pictures of them. I think this is a number of years ago because I worked on the film for quite a few years. And I just thought, well, you know, how do I see that? How do I see a Luna moth? And I did some research about how people attract moths to light. How do you put up a mothing sheet? And so then I did that. And within the first time or two that I started attracting moths to light, this sort of world opened up in front of me that I just had no idea existed. Most of the film was shot in my backyard. A little bit of it was shot up at McDowell the artist residency up in New Hampshire. But almost all of it was shot in my backyard in Tivoli, New York. And, you know, it's like, so if you live in the Hudson Valley or live really wherever you live, if you have a backyard and a light, you can see these things that are just kind of amazing. I think most people think of moths as being these little, you know, nondescript brown pests. And so to see just the range of kind of beauty, and as you say, that some of them have what almost looks like fur, although, of course, it's not fur, it's scales, but just that beauty is kind of was overwhelming to me.
You have title cards that appear throughout the film, and I'm going to quote one that appears. You wrote, "It's 2:30 in the morning. No one else is awake. I don't know if I'm talking to myself or to the moths. I'm becoming old and strange, and I worry that moths are part of my retreat from people." Can you explain?
That sounds very serious when you say it that way. Usually when the film shows, gets a little bit of a laugh. I think the other thing that was going on when I started working on the film, so I talked about how I wanted to see a Luna moth. The other sort of thread that I was following was I was getting older, and as I think as often happens to people when they get a bit older, I started having really bad middle insomnia. I was able to go to sleep, but I would wake up in the middle of the night, and when you have middle insomnia, you kind of lay there and stare at the ceiling and have thoughts about mortality and things like that. And so I thought, well, let me get out of bed and do something active. And so that was part of the impulse to stay up late and moth. But when you're up in your backyard or wherever you are as a mothing sheet, for me, it's a rather solitary activity. Unlike bird watching, which I'm also a bird person, unlike bird watching, which there's a lot more bird watchers than there are moth people, you do that. I often would do that in groups. With mothing, it was always just me and the sheet and the moths. That does feel very solitary. And I did often feel like when I would be talking to the moths, I wasn't quite sure if I was talking to myself or to the moths. Yeah.
Well, also with insects who live such shorter lives than humans, especially with moths and butterflies, you see their entire life cycle within a matter. I mean, everyone remembers hatching caterpillars maybe in their elementary school classroom, and you see it turn into a pupa or a chrysalis, and then the adult emerges. So in thoughts of in life and in mortality, and do you see an overlap? Yeah, do you see an overlap with your study of moths and insects?
Totally, totally. I mean, you can't, as you say, you can't help but think about that. As part of the film, you may have noticed that there's a spine or a thread that runs through the film. I raise Cecropia moths, which are the largest moths in North America, these really big, beautiful moths, a native silk moth. And I got some eggs and then, raised them through each of the different, it's called instars, the different stages of the caterpillars. And it was really a tremendous amount of work. I had to go out many times a day and get maple leaves for them. And I got super, super attached to them. I mean, they became like my babies, like my pets or my friends even. We went on vacation that summer. This is the summer of 2019. We went on vacation that summer, and I was raising them in these big plastic buckets, and we took the plastic buckets with us on vacation.
Did you go on vacation?
Well, we went up to New Hampshire, where my partner's family is from. Luckily, we didn't fly anywhere. That would have been a problem. It was, again, a lot of work. And then at the end of that season, they all the Cecropia, fifth instar Cecropia caterpillars all wove cocoons, which was great. And my idea had been, you know, when you make a film like this, a sort of, as you called it, impressionistic or experimental, organic kind of film, you're always thinking about, like, what is the spine or the thread that I can use to weave the whole thing together? And I knew pretty early, or at least I knew at that point, I thought maybe, well, I'll raise these Cecropias and then I'll keep coming back to them throughout their life cycle, and that will be like a thread for the film. So I raised them and they wove their cocoons, and I thought, oh, well, that's fantastic. You know, I got that really great looking footage of each stage of their lives, and I didn't think, you know, I put them in my shed to overwinter, because they have to overwinter where it's cold. If they overwinter inside, they'll hatch out too early. So I put them in my shed, and I thought, well, that was the end of that. And then the next spring of 2020, the COVID spring, you know, one warm late May day, I brought them out and set them on a picnic table in the sun, and they started hatching out. It was really the most unbelievable thing, one of the most unbelievable things I've ever experienced, one of the most moving things I've ever experienced. Here we are in this COVID lockdown, all of us in our cocoons, and then here are these guys that are just like bursting forth and flying away. So it was really a very moving experience for me.
A lot of people made bread as a hobby.
Oh, yeah. And I raised cats. I raised moths, yeah.
The idea of the transformation.
It all starts right there. It all starts right there.
How they grow. How they grow. Change and transform. Change and transform.
Change and transform. The way that they look.
Talking about the Cecropia moths, that's an important part of the film, is you talk about the history of what began as an experiment to bring silk to the United States, and then what ended up in an ecological disaster that we're still seeing the effects of.
Yeah.
And that's a very broad way of describing it, but particularly the Cecropia moths are a part of that. Can you explain why you decided to go down that thread and talk about the plight of this particular moth? Is it because this is what you had on hand because they're so visually beautiful, or was it because you knew of this history? Was it something you explored along the way?
I didn't know the history. We're talking about the story of Étienne Trouvelot, who was a French artist and amateur astronomer and amateur entomologist, took it into his head that he would try to raise silk moths in late 1850s, early 1860s. There had been a silk industry in the United States, apparently. And again, I didn't know any of this history. Had been a silk industry in the United States up until the 1940s, when there was a speculative bubble in mulberry trees, which burst, and then nobody raised mulberry trees anymore. And mulberry trees are the food stock for Bombyx mori, which is the domesticated silk moth.
More common in Asia.
Yeah. But they were imported here and were being raised here, you know, to make a silk industry, which collapsed. And so Trouvelot decided he would try to figure out some other way of making silk. And so he started with native North American silk moths, with the Polyphemus moth particularly. And the story is that he thought, well, that's great, but the Polyphemus moth, the silk isn't really perfect for this, and maybe if I crossbreed it with some other silk moth, I could make a better silk. And he went to Europe and looked around, and somehow he brought back a moth that we call the spongy moth now, Lamantria dispar is the scientific name, and which is not a good thing to have around. Many people in the WAMC listening area have been dealing with the spongy moth over the last number of years. Part of my film, I went up to near Lake George and met a very nice person who let me film in their backyard, just this devastation of the spongy moth. The spongy moth got loose, started devastating trees. And then in the early 1900s, people thought, well, what can we do about this? They were just spraying poison everywhere, which didn't seem to work and was obviously poisonous. And so they got a native parasite, a parasitic fly from the spongy moth's European range, and brought it here and let it go. And did not work out so well. So it did do a little bit for this, against the spongy moth, but not very much. And mostly attacked or is parasitic on native silk moths, and the Cecropia moth in particular, but all the native silk moths. So
it's quite a story.
Yeah.
And you say that Truvolo died before he saw the results of this.
Yeah.
Because this parasite that was brought in to control the populations was brought in by the U.S. government in the 20th century. But
yeah,
these experiments with Truvolo and trying to find a better American silk,
yeah,
was in the 19th century.
Yeah, he had gone back to France at that point. I mean, after his silk experiments didn't work out, he actually had this whole other great career as making astronomical illustrations, which are in my film as well. And then at a certain point went back to France and died there in, I think, 1895, before all of this became clear. But it was kind of like a good, good example of the way people think. They're figuring out how ecosystems work, but they often don't really know all the ramifications, all the different connection points in an ecosystem. So.
Watching these moths, either the Cecropia moths hatch and develop in your own backyard, or studying this entire world of creatures, you know, did this connect you more to other parts of the natural world, or your own connection with nature itself?
I think I've always sort of felt some, I've always felt some connection to the natural systems. As I said, I was a bird watcher before. I think this increased that. The one thing I would say maybe about that is that I'm not a bug person, you know?
Neither am I.
Yeah, I mean, I'm actually, and I think the film sort of talks about this a little bit in one of those intertitle moments. Like, I'm actually really afraid of bugs, or at least some bugs. You know, I divide my time between New York City and the Hudson Valley, and in my apartment in New York City, we have those large water beetles, those big cockroaches, which I do not like and I'm very scared of. So my reaction to bugs is not, is fear, basically, bug fear. And so it was really interesting to me to sort of find this other way of thinking about insects and being around insects that was not full of fear, that was, full of awe and wonder and joy. So that to me was kind of a revelation.
Did you overcome a lot of those fears?
Well, actually, I have to say that I never felt fear around moths. I know some people are actually, phobic of moths. I've had people tell me, oh, I'd love to see your film, but I can't see it because I'm so scared of moths. So I understand that. But even from the beginning, I would be in this mothing world, like up to my sheet, although I would use a board because it photographs better than a sheet. But I would be up to my mothing board and there would be a cloud of moths around my head. And it would just be like, great, I'm just in a cloud of moths. It wouldn't bother me at all. If it was a cloud of some other insects, I would be freaking out. But I do sort of feel like being around moths made me somewhat less afraid of other insects. I mean, I still don't like water beetles, but
I'm not a fan of caterpillars.
Oh yeah.
And I was watching this documentary, and part of me was squirming my seat a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
I stuck through it. You know?
It's pretty like, the close-ups of their mouths and the sounds and all of that.
The number of species is enormous. Most species-rich organisms in the world.
Other than beetles.
So talking about the sounds of the film, you have original music that you composed and performed.
Yeah.
And you also have animations that are synced in some ways to the music as well. What was the vibe you were going for when you put the music together?
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned at the beginning this sort of impressionist. Oh, yeah, I think you mentioned David Lynch at the beginning. And, you know, in a way, it's... when you make a film about insects, almost inevitably it takes on a kind of science fiction aspect. There's sort of a science fiction aspect to really almost any film about insects because they are so unlike us. And I think that's one of the things that the film grapples with, and certainly one of the things that I grappled with as when I was making the film and thinking about while I was making the film, while I was shooting it, you know, I'm looking at these incredibly beautiful creatures, and I have no idea what, you know, when you're around birds or around your cat, you have some sense like, oh, here's a creature that I can understand, that I can have some relationship to. But when you're around an insect, a moth, there's just no way to have that kind of relationship. And so that uncanniness creates a sort of science fiction vibe for me, and I think that's maybe where the music was going.
And you also reference an Edgar Allan Poe story in the documentary itself.
Yeah, there's a Poe story that maybe many people will know called The Sphinx.
Near the close of an exceedingly warm day, I was sitting book in hand at an open window. My thoughts had long been wandering from the volume before me to the desolation of the forsaken city. Uplifting my eyes from the page, they fell upon the distant landscape, and there, upon some living monster of hideous form.
That, like a lot of Poe stories, is a little hard to tell at what level of humor and horror he's kind of working. Like, it seems to be pretty self-conscious. It's very scary and horrible, but it also seems to be sort of self-consciously jokey. And so, you know, I've always liked that about Poe. Poe is like, for me, I have a Poe features in a couple of other films of mine. Poe is like the one thing that unites the 12-year-old me with the me now. And that story takes place during a cholera epidemic in New York. It takes place in the Hudson Valley during a cholera epidemic that was happening in New York. I turned to that story and started working on that story in April of 2020, just as the pandemic was starting. So I think maybe it's another way that the film intersects with the pandemic.
What is the message that you want to share with the audience who is going to see this film? What do you want them to come away with?
Well, I think, as I said maybe at the beginning, that it's that you might come away with this view of this nearby world that you did not know existed, that's like a hidden, that's been hidden from you in a way, that if you look for it, it's right there. And so that to me, again, it was a revelation to me and a surprise to me, and maybe I hope it would be a revelation and a surprise to the audience as well.
And what's your next filmmaking project?
Well, you know, having just finished this film and sort of playing it around at some festivals, and maybe I'll mention here that it's playing on Thursday, April 18th at the Amherst Cinema at 7 p.m. And you can go on their website.
In Amherst, Massachusetts.
In Amherst, Massachusetts, that's right. In a series called Bellwether, which, as I understand, is free for members of the Amherst Cinema. But having just finished the film and just, you know, following it around and traveling with it a little bit, I'm still kind of working on what I'm working on, thinking about what I'm going to be working on next. I've been in a little bit of a shift of gears from biology to maybe history, I've been reading a lot about cuneiform culture and the early history of Mesopotamia, because that idea of the transformation from the writing on clay to writing on paper and the sort of drop-off of the information that comes through to us in that transformation, the fact that there's all of these clay tablets preserved and then suddenly very few, there's not much paper papyrus preserved from that same era, makes me think a lot about the contemporary transformation we're going through from paper to digital and what will be left, you know, in the future from that.
Well, I look forward to seeing that one too.
Great.
Thanks, Michael, so much for
Thank
coming
you,
in.
Lucas,
I appreciate
for having
it.
Me. I really appreciate you having me, Lucas.
Michael Gitlin is the filmmaker behind The Night Visitors, an experimental documentary about moths. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. And now, a little preview of what's coming up on the next episode of The Best of Our Knowledge. The Florida Museum's Open Vertebrate Project is giving a new look at specimens tucked away in permanent collections. Using advanced 3D scan technology, the Overt team is working to produce high-resolution anatomical data from 20,000 fluid-preserved specimens. I'll speak with the University of Florida's David Blackburn.
The reality is that not everybody realizes that behind the exhibits are collections, that behind the exhibits are scientists, you know, whether or not you're an archaeologist or you're a cultural historian, or you're a frog scientist. Most people don't realize that behind the museum, behind the walls of the museum exhibits are people in collections. And so it's hard to bring everybody behind the scenes, right? It's crowded. We're running out of space to put our things. We can't bring millions of people behind the scenes. But being able to create these sort of realistic looking 3D models of the stuff behind the scenes means that suddenly these 3D models are in classrooms. They're in art studios. They are just being viewed by the public and a wider audience online.
David Blackburn and the Florida Museum's Overt Project on the next episode of The Best of Our Knowledge. If you'd like to tell The Best of Our Knowledge what you think, send us an email at knowledge@wamc.org. You can listen to The Best of Our Knowledge anytime as a podcast, downloadable wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to catch up on past episodes or hear more WAMC National Productions programs on the news, academic study, books, women's issues, the media, and the environment, visit WAMCpodcasts.org. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1751. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Thanks to associate producer Jody Cowan, the latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.